What do we know about Facebook today that we didn't know yesterday?
And where could it grow from here?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's February 2nd.
Coming up, the economic bright spot that is Nebraska.
And we'll preview tomorrow's jobs report.
Plus, economists play groundhog and predict our economic future.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Right after Wall Street wrapped up trading yesterday, Facebook did just what analysts had been anticipating for years and filed papers to sell stock to the public.
As part of that required government filing, the social networking giant had to expose a lot about itself. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has been going through the details, and she joins us now from Washington with more. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So tell us some Facebook secrets that we've learned in the last 24 hours.
Well, here's a juicy one. Facebook made a $1 billion profit last year. Also, Facebook is looking over its shoulder. It says it's worried about competition. Google, for one, Jeremy, has ads that are more targeted because it knows exactly what we're searching for. And Google generates a lot more profit per user than Facebook does. And that's something investors look at to gauge a company's value. So Facebook has to figure out how to get more money out of us. It's already says it's going to keep more of our information, so maybe there's more of that type of thing coming. But Facebook will save some money on founder Mark Zuckerberg's salary starting next year. He's only going to be paid $1 a year.
So taking a little bit of a pay cut, maybe, but...
Yeah, just a little.
Well, okay, so Facebook gets some money out of this when they go public. They bring in more cash. What are the downsides for Facebook?
Well, the company's going to have to disclose a lot more about itself and how it operates. It'll have to release financial reports every few months. It didn't have to do that before. Zuckerberg has made it very clear, though, that he is still going to run the company and investors won't have much of a say. Now, some analysts say Facebook should be worried about more government regulation. Josh Bernoff is senior vice president at Forrester Research.
The regulators from the EU in Brussels and in Washington could basically handicap the company by putting in rules about how they have to treat customer data. This would be a huge challenge.
And it's an ongoing one. Some Facebook users want more security for their data.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Once Facebook goes public, it will have billions of dollars to spend. After Google went public, it bought dozens of startups, and Facebook is expected to do the same. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
To get an idea of where Facebook might spend its money, take out your smartphone and try uploading photos to your Facebook page. Deborah Williamson is an analyst with eMarketer. She's tried it.
Then you go, wait a second, I want to upload, 20 photos. I don't want to upload one at a time, and I can't find a way to do that on my mobile.
Williamson says Facebook needs to improve the mobile experience, especially if it wants to keep attracting new users. Facebook agrees. Six of the 11 companies it bought last year dealt in mobile.
I wouldn't be surprised if they make more acquisitions in the mobile front.
She says Facebook may also buy companies for their human assets, the tech geeks who work there. Rebecca Lieb is with the Altimeter Group.
Facebook is probably going to start having a bit of an attrition problem when it goes public and creates a bunch of instant, 20-something millionaires overnight. Some of these people are going to want to buy homes or travel or drive Maseratis.
Writing code, driving a Maserati. That's a tough choice. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Facebook already has 845 million users, but future investors are going to want even more.
Well, China is one place the social media site could look. Facebook isn't allowed there now, but as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the company hasn't given up.
China has half a billion internet users. Without special software, none of them can access Facebook. For the company's new shareholders, that'll sound like a market Facebook needs to tap into. But first, Facebook will have to convince China's government to like it.
The Chinese internet authorities don't like big user-generated content sites who are not run by Chinese companies that self-censor.
Jeremy Goldcorn is editor of Donwei.com, a website devoted to Chinese media. He says in order to play in China, Facebook will have to offer a localized version that would be censored, sort of like Twitter's new country-specific censorship program.
If you were in Thailand and you were tweeting insults to the king, which is illegal in Thailand, Twitter would have the ability to make sure that nobody in Thailand could see that tweet. You know, this is the type of thing that Facebook would have to do.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg says he's learning Chinese and he's come to China to scope out the landscape. The question is he ready to change Facebook for access to China's market? In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
All right, one more thing about Facebook before we move on. Analysts have been waiting for months, maybe even years, for this announcement. So why did it happen now? Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us now from Chicago, as she is every Thursday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why is now the moment for a company like Facebook to decide to go public?
Well, a lot of IPOs were waiting on the sidelines for the market to do better. And in fact, January was a very robust mark for very robust month for market gains, and so it gives an opportunity to sort of ride that wave and try to get the best pricing you can.
And what is it about a strong market that makes it good for a company to decide to go public?
Well, of course, they want to get as much money as they possibly can, and they get better valued in a market where people are moving in to make riskier bets on the future. IPOs are those kind of bets. You're betting on a company that's just brand new, higher chance of failure, but also could have much higher returns for anyone who's trying to get some returns out there.
Now, you focus a lot on the Federal Reserve, which has been trying to reduce interest rates and therefore, in some ways, get people to get off the sidelines and into the marketplace. Is this happening? Is the Fed's dream coming true?
Well, this is part of the Fed's dream. I mean, they'd like to see a lot more market activity. Much of the magic of the 1990s boom in employment was driven by small businesses, IPOs, and new business formation. Of course, a lot of that wasn't sustainable. But the idea is to get people from making non-productive investments, holding on to cash, and getting them into making more productive, riskier investments in the future. So some of this is happening, investing in equities, investing in high-yield bonds. That movement has begun to occur as the Fed has taken the action. It is. So this is the direction the Fed wants to move, just not fast as they'd like to see it occur.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
The number of folks applying for unemployment last week dipped, another sign that maybe the job market is improving. But we also got numbers today that planned layoffs in January were at a four-month high. Turns out it's not as bad as it might sound. Joining us to explain is John Challenger from Challenger, Gray & Christmas. Good morning.
Good morning, Adrian.
So January is typically the heaviest month of layoffs. Why is that?
The end of the year and the beginning are normally the two heaviest times for layoffs. Companies have received their results from the previous year, and if things haven't gone well, they choose to make their adjustments quickly so they can move on.
Now, how is this January different from others?
Layoffs were up almost 40% from January of 2010, but last year's January numbers were a record low. Layoffs generally are much lighter than they were during the winter and the early springs of the recession.
So this isn't necessarily bad news?
It's certainly not bad news. I mean, anytime you see layoffs, it's a big concern, but it doesn't look as though we're in line for a big new round of layoffs.
Now, speaking to that, in the last few weeks, we did get news of significant layoffs from Kraft. American Airlines now says it wants to cut 13,000 jobs. Are these just outliers?
Well, we'll see. We have seen more layoffs lately in areas like finance and government and pharmaceutical. In fact, there was a big cut by AstraZeneca today. But the economy looks to be in relatively stable condition. There's been consistent job creation from the private sector. One reason that we've seen these recent layoffs is we've seen some mergers, some acquisitions, and those kinds of reasons for layoffs aren't necessarily signs of weakness or harbingers of worse things to come.
John Challenger from Challenger, Gray & Christmas. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, the weekly jobless claims we got from the Labor Department, John Challenger's numbers, they both lead up to tomorrow's big monthly employment report from the Labor Department.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
So how do Americans feel about the job market? Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup. He joins us every Thursday for our attitude check. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So Gallup does its own jobs polling. What trends are you spotting right now?
Well, we spotted unemployment actually decreasing some in the middle of January. It was 8.5 in December. And by our calculations, we interview 30,000 people a month. We had unemployment down to 8.3 by the middle of the month, but it's actually come back up near the end of the month. So we'll see what happens. We think the government should be reporting unemployment about the same or maybe slightly improved. But I have to give a caveat here. The government seasonally adjusts their data, and they're actually going to some new weighting procedures based on new census data this month. So kind of a crapshoot what they'll show. But we think unemployment's been fairly steady, maybe improving slightly, at least through the middle of January.
And what are you hearing from people about their expectations for the job market?
Expectations for the economy in general is how we track it, and they're getting slightly better than we have seen previously. That's economic confidence, although that, too, has seen a slight deterioration near the end of January.
Now, we heard President Obama propose giving tax breaks to companies to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. What do you know about support for that kind of proposal?
Oh, that's widespread. In fact, this is very unusual. We have over 8 out of 10 Americans who, in general, support that idea. But what's unusual when we look beneath the data here is this is one of the few things that the president proposes that has unanimous support from both Democrats and Republicans. I say unanimous. It's got over 80% support on both sides of the aisle, and that's highly unusual. So this is something that I think the president, anybody actually, can go out and say, yeah, let's bring jobs back with tax breaks or whatever, and you're going to get overwhelming support from the average American.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup. Thanks.
You bet.
Well, we're just 2 days away from the Nevada Republican caucus, so let's continue our Marketplace election series, The Real Economy Now, with a story of a state that is essentially the economic opposite of Nevada. It's a state that relies on farming, and with high crop prices, farmers aren't saving. They're paying down debt, buying more land, and investing in new equipment. Marketplace's David Gura takes us now to the economic bright spot that is Nebraska.
Tom Joyce caters to some pretty high-end clients.
I tell our salesmen we're dealing with millionaires every day, and you make sure you treat them well. I mean, like you're the maitre d' of a nice restaurant.
Joyce manages the Plains Equipment Group. It's a John Deere dealership just off I-80. Each piece of merchandise he sells, a new tractor, a new combine, costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. Think of it this way.
These guys buy Lamborghinis and Ferraris every year. They'll buy a $250,000 machine that they'll use for 6 weeks of the year.
Now we're looking at a 16-row John Deere planter.
Mark Jagels keeps one of those forest green farm Ferraris in his equipment shed. He grows corn and soybeans in Davenport, Nebraska, about 80 miles away.
Quiet. It is totally quiet. And I mean, we're sitting there probably half throttle, and you don't hardly hear anything.
The tractor's Bluetooth-enabled with satellite radio and air conditioning. It's computerized with GPS.
The monitor here, that is everything from our guidance and controls the planter and everything right there.
In the winter, Jagels programs the system with his laptop. He tells it what to plant and where, how much fertilizer goes on a line of crops. Then, in the springtime,
I find that field, I bring up that line, boom, it's right there. You should never be off more than 1 or 2 inches as you're driving through the field.
Jagel says farming isn't as physical as it used to be. It requires less labor. Today, a tractor like this one can pretty much drive itself.
I can flip the steering wheel up, I can sit here, I can answer emails, I can do whatever I want to.
And according to Jagels, there's a lot less waste. In the kitchen, he shows me a printout with data from the tractor.
Planted soybeans, the average rate was 169,390 seeds per acre. It gives me the total seeds applied and the total acres that I planted.
And that kind of information, Jagel says, that efficiency is worth every penny. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now on to Washington for another agriculture story, this one about child labor laws. Congress today is asking questions about kids working on farms. The government wants to impose new rules limiting that farm work, but those rules are being reconsidered after an outcry from farmers. Elizabeth Wynn Johnson reports.
The tug of war between federal regulators and the guardians of tradition doesn't get much more American than this.
Who gets to decide if it's okay for a child to work in a pen with an aggressive, uncastrated farm animal? Congressman Scott Tipton is a Colorado Republican and chair of a House subcommittee on small business. He says Washington doesn't get what he calls the matrix of agricultural America.
I come from a farm and ranch community. You know, these are great-grandparents, grandparents, parents who live in the same area, share their labor force, which happens to be family.
On the same House subcommittee, California Democrat Judy Chu says child labor laws are overdue for an update and should be made tougher.
When you hear about horrific incidents like where young people are killed in the grain silos, you know that something must be done about it.
According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, three-quarters of the children killed in work-related accidents in 2010 were working on farms. In Washington, I'm Elizabeth Wynn Johnson for Marketplace.
In Australia, a bus company owner sold his company, but instead of pocketing the money, he decided to share it with his employees. The BBC's Duncan Kennedy reports now from Sydney.
They're already calling him Australia's best boss. Ken Grender has just sold his bus company and decided to spread his good fortune. His 1,800 staff are each getting a share of $15 million, an average of $8,000 each. Ken says he's dismayed how much some executives are earning and wanted to reward his loyal staff.
Bus drivers, as these guys will testify, aren't the highest paid people in town, but they're totally dedicated. They've worked very hard. We've had people here for 40 and even 50 years working for us. That's all of their working life. We just felt that they deserved a decent reward at the end of it.
Some employees wept when they heard the news. Others phoned their banks, thinking the extra money in their account must be a mistake. One said he would take his first ever holiday, whilst employee Shane Baker says his daughter's big day can now go ahead.
Me and my wife were struggling to work out how we were going to pay for my daughter's wedding, and now I don't have to work 7 days. I've only got to work 6 days a week. So, but it just came at such an opportune time.
Ken Grender has been in his family bus business for 66 years. He says the giveaway has been liberating, making him living proof that in a world of corporate excess, there exists one bus company boss who's decided to play fair. In Sydney, I'm the BBC's Duncan Kennedy for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, we heard a few days ago about news that an official at Claremont McKenna in Southern California inflated admission scores to encourage better students to apply.
Right.
Well, now a bunch of law schools are being sued for falsifying employment rates for graduates.
That's right. The law schools allegedly misrepresented the percentage of students who get jobs after graduation in order to attract more students. Here to talk with us about this is our education correspondent, Amy Scott. She's at the Marketplace Education Desk at WYP. PR in Baltimore. Hi, Amy.
Hi, guys.
So what do we know about this story at this point?
Well, what we know is that these lawsuits allege that law schools are misleading applicants about how likely they are to get jobs after they graduate. The lawsuits say that the schools are inflating job placement figures by doing things like hiring their own graduates for temporary jobs and counting any kind of employment, not just in the legal profession.
Now, what is the job market for law students like today?
Well, there's a tremendous glut of lawyers. The legal profession was hit pretty hard by the recession. And the problem, these students say, is that, you know, law school is expensive. It can cost upwards of $150,000. And the average graduate comes out owing more than $90,000, according to U.S. News. So in the past, that debt was seen as justified because of the highly paid jobs. But these days, a lot of students are graduating and not able to get those jobs.
But are law school graduates any worse off than any other graduates in this job market?
Well, I think it would be hard to argue that, except that they have these high debt levels. You know, when you owe six figures to the bank,
right.
I think it's tougher to be to have temporary work or to be unemployed.
You know, Amy, when I saw this story this morning, I wondered if law students aren't just complaining that, you know, the law school is at fault for the fact that they can't get a job. Is there anything to that?
Well, I think that to be fair, these students are facing a really tough market. When many of them entered law school, the economy was in much better shape, and they were all but guaranteed to have a highly paid job. Things have obviously changed quite a bit. The legal industry is really cyclical, so they feel that they were misled.
Now, is there any chance a suit like this has any merit that will actually go anywhere?
The lawyers say they're going to be suing dozens more schools, so we definitely will see more of this. In terms of the legal standing they have, you know, we can look at what's happened in the for-profit college industry. There have been a lot of suits like this, alleging that schools have misrepresented their employment figures. So, you know, the courts are certainly taking these seriously.
Marketplace's Amy Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
And finally,
that's right, Woodchuck Chuckers, it's Groundhog Day!
Punxsutawney Phil did see his shadow this morning, which means six more weeks of winter or whatever this nationwide heat wave is.
Well, this February 2nd, we asked a couple economists to play groundhog for us and help predict the economic future. First to peek out, Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group.
If I were the groundhog, I think I'd be pretty confused at the moment. The economy's been muddling along for the past year, and I'd have a hard time figuring out whether that's going to accelerate into something resembling strength or deteriorate into something resembling a recession.
All right, that's one prediction. Here's Tara Sinclair at the George Washington University with another.
I don't know as a groundhog if I'm going to see my economic shadow because I need to know what's going on with Europe and if it's a cloud over our sky or not.
Now, groundhog number three, Charles Ballard. He's an econ professor at Michigan State University.
The biggest shadow, I think, is the European debt situation. So far, the Europeans have managed to sort of limp along and not let things spin out of control. I think that'll continue, but it is a real concern.
And for one more prediction, let's go to Jack Ablin with Harris Private Bank.
Poking my head out of my burrow here, I think that things are looking to improve. What we're looking at is a situation in Europe that's not deteriorating. It's really just staying sideways. And the longer the news stays sideways, the more insulated I think we all become.
If you want to join our gang of economic groundhogs, head to our website at marketplace.org.
Just click on the groundhog. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.